Welcome to The Writers Co-op, a business podcast for freelance writers everywhere.
We are your co-hosts. I'm Jenny Gritters.
And I'm Wudan Gan.
This week, it's our last episode of season one.
Yay! I kind of can't believe it.
I know.
We've recorded this entire season in the middle of a pandemic while I've been on the COVID beat since March, and Jenny has returned from maternity leave and is balancing all of it.
Yeah, it has been a wild time to say the least, but we are here. We're still here. So, you know, Wudan and I started this podcast thinking of it as a way to store all of our knowledge in one place so we could refer people to these episodes when they needed help. And it's really turned into so much more than that. Whether you are just tuning in or you've been hanging out all season, or some people lately have told us that they've been binge listening to the entire season all at once, we just want to say thank you for supporting us and giving us ideas about what to cover, for attending our workshops and events, and supporting us on Patreon. We're really excited for season two.
If you are a Patreon member, you will get one more episode after this one. A member-only episode about our secret sauce. You'll get that whether you're a basic, all-access, or VIP member. And while we're between seasons, our members will also still get access to events, newsletters, and additional resources. So, Jenny, how are we ending this first season?
We are going to talk about ways to grow your writing career.
I'm excited. I get so many questions about this all the time.
Yeah, and I think this concept of growing your career is definitely confusing when you're a freelancer because there's not really a set route to take. Like, you don't have a manager who's pushing you to grow your skills or who's trying to get you promoted. So I think about this a lot and I wonder, like, if I'm doing this for 10 or 20 years, how do I make progress and move up in the industry? So I'm still answering this question for myself, and I think Wudan is too, but we're going to try to talk about a few different methods of career growth here.
Also, just a side note that a lot of what we mentioned in this episode is largely for freelance journalism, but some themes may apply to other types of freelance writing and editing as well. So Jenny, where should we start?
I think it makes sense to start at the beginning, like getting into this field to begin with. Do you need special training?
Yes. I get so many questions about whether or not someone should go to journalism school or go to school for their MFA or whatever. So, Jenny, what do you think about that as somebody who did go to J school? And I guess what I'm really asking is, what value did that add to your career now? And all in all, was the money and time investment worth it?
Oh man, I have so many thoughts about this. So, as you said, I got a master's degree in journalism at Boston University. After finishing up my undergrad degree at Bucknell, I went straight there. I didn't have any journalism experience prior, except for a few travel writing internships where basically I just would take trips in Italy and write about them. So I'm not even sure it really counted as journalism. But because of that, I knew I needed to build up some basic skills if I wanted to pursue this path. And to be honest, I was also pretty lost when it came to career direction at the end of college. So I applied to 3 master's programs as a fallback on the recommendation of my advisor. And I got a really hefty scholarship, so I ended up at Boston University. So when I talk to people about this, I say there are some very notable pros and some notable cons when it comes to journalism school. And your decision to attend or not really depends on what things you feel like you need to add to your skill set in order to take on this really tough industry. I think the biggest con is that journalism school is often really freaking expensive. Like, most programs are at private universities, and the cost is in the neighborhood of at least $100,000 for a year or two. Most programs are in cities around the US that are expensive to live in. And after you graduate, you know, if you're working in this industry, you know you're not going to be making a ton of money. You're not going to be able to pay those loans back quickly. So you may be saddled with debt for years. It's definitely different from taking out loans to pursue a career that will eventually pay for itself, right? Like, media isn't very financially lucrative, especially at the beginning. So if you can find a way around the financial burden, like using savings or getting scholarships, I think that makes this decision a little bit more straightforward.
Right. Or you can be like Jenny and just out of the gate, use your massive loans to go after projects that will pay lots of money to help pay them off.
It's true. It's a big motivator for me. My loans are actually paid off because I got a big scholarship that covered my tuition and some living expenses. I worked as a graduate assistant. So that's why I ultimately decided to go to this program. But my husband also has a lot of student loans. I could talk forever about the pros and cons of carrying a loan burden around. It's really tough. And I think it's something that comes into play when you're thinking about attending a journalism school program. There are some big pros to going to journalism school, though. And for me, the biggest benefit, I don't think, was skill building which I think you can do by yourself if you're industrious, right? You can learn how to do some of this work. But the biggest pro for me was the connections. And I've talked before about running that journalism conference in Boston. So a lot of my connections and mentorship opportunities came from that conference. And the conference was a part of my grad program. The people I graduated with are also my industry colleagues now, which is really cool. And that network has been really huge for me in terms of my success. I think it's the biggest benefit of attending a graduate program. And of course, the classes are also usually pretty interesting. If you like learning, which I do, like I would probably sign up to go to school forever if I could. It's really cool to be able to sit in a classroom and like noodle around on the existential issues that surround journalism, like ethics and history and craft. When else in your career are you going to be able to have time dedicated to that? Probably not very often.
Yeah, or you learn all those things by making mistakes.
Yes.
I think that's something I wish I had dedicated time for. I learned most of all of that on the job, right? Like I said. And I also know that journalism school or any other graduate program can be really, really, really useful for people of color. Getting that degree gives a lot of folks from marginalized groups a leg up when getting hired, especially if employers, and I mean staff or freelance, right, wouldn't bat an eye at them otherwise.
For sure. I think journalism school can definitely be useful for some people. So it's always hard for me to give an answer of like, should you do this or not? But you don't need it. Like you do not need it, right? You can enter this field and meet people and you can break into journalism yourself, just like you did, Wudan, without that quote unquote traditional training, but it might be tougher.
Yes. I don't want to rehash what I've already said in a previous episode because airtime is so valuable, but I just want to remind everyone to start small and keep building on your prior experiences and networks. It is possible to get into this without going to school, but I really think it takes persistence and hard work.
One other question we get asked about a lot is certifications. Like, do you need a certification to become an editor or a fact checker? Or, for example, is it worth it to take a data journalism course or something to teach you how to take better photos? Wudan, what do you think about that?
I am actually not aware of certificates in the US for things like that. I have heard of some certificates like that in Canada. And I will say there are also so many courses out there to develop certain skill sets. So for data journalism, the Investigative Reporters and Editors group, they have a lot of workshops across the country that focus on filing public records requests, building your own databases, learning Python, etc. I'm about to say something possibly controversial, but all the learning that I've done is from the job or from workshops at conferences. Even throwing together a podcast, we kind of just, right, like figured it out as we went. The best thing to do is learn from experience. And if learning in a formal setting or getting a certificate or a degree for that matter gives you the boost of confidence to go after the things you want to do, great. But I don't think you have to necessarily throw a lot of money into training. What do you think, Jenny?
Yeah, like I said before, I'm really into learning. I'm nerdy. I like school. So occasionally I've enrolled in really cheap, massive online courses for skill building. Like I did a social media certification through Pointer at the beginning of my career. I am a trained yoga teacher. I've also done some online photography workshops, but I definitely agree. Like I don't usually spend a lot of money on those things, and just doing the work and learning on the job has always been more effective for me in terms of skill building. I also, when I was hiring people, when I was an editor, would always pay more attention to experience than I would to certifications. So if you really feel like you don't know where to start, a certification can maybe help you sort of get 10 steps down the road, right? But I don't think it's necessary. And I don't think media companies will only hire editors who have an editing certification. For example, if you're working with a brand or trade publication, maybe they would be more likely to hire you if you have a niche certification. But in my experience, what matters more is the publications and clients on your resume, people you've worked with in the past.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And it's not just for editing or fact checking. For journalists and writers, getting bylines and recognizable outlets like The New York Times, Washington Post, New Yorker, or any other magazines, I think is really key. And I think for people who work with brands, having a good lineup of past clients makes a difference too. I wonder, Jenny, if you can speak to this from an editor's perspective. Like, how much do these names matter? And what do they tell you?
They matter a lot. So when I would skim through pitches from people as an editor, I would almost always check where people had been published in the past. It was, I think, the first thing I looked at. I would click through to their website, look at their clips, and also like look at those italicized names in the pitch, right, of the publication. So if they had a big name publication on their roster, whether it was for writing or editing, I always felt like that was a good sign. Now, you don't need 20 of those, right? You just need a few. I think it makes you more hireable, both for brands and for media companies. I also want to recognize that this kind of sucks because we all know that one big byline doesn't mean that someone is skilled at the craft of journalism, right? But when you're emailing a swamped editor who's totally skimming the pile, like they have 50 pitches to look through, you need a way to sort of set yourself apart from the rest, right, to get your foot in the door. And having a big name publication is one of the ways to do that. So as for what that tells you as an editor, if I see that you've written for a big name publication before, it tells me that you likely understand what it's like to be on the world stage, right? Like you're used to having your writing in front of a lot of people. You also probably understand the editing process, what it's like to have your words changed, what it's like to have a high standard for factual accuracy, things like that. And it shows me that you're used to putting yourself out there because you've probably pitched those places and landed those pitches, right? So it sort of speaks to your professionalism, I think, also maybe your tenacity, experience, and skills. But like I said before, it kind of sucks because there are a lot of other power politics at play in terms of who's landing pitches in those publications. And I also think you don't need a ton of these big names. Like just one is probably enough to show me that you know what to do if I give you the assignment.
Totally. I also think generally that having quote unquote prestige clips is a good move to show that you have story ideas that suit, right? Like that broader audience and that you have the chops to pull those stories off.
For sure.
I had a coaching client ask me recently about how I got so many big bylines. And my advice is generally start small with the stories you write, the places you pitch, the people you network with. And once you have enough momentum and more confidence, I always just recommend people to pitch more aggressively, network. And I think people forget how effective pitching can be as a networking tool. So let me just pull back the curtain a little bit again. As one of the things that I get tons of questions about, I got my first New Yorker, which was online, commission about a year and some change into freelancing. And that's because an editor there once read some of my work at Discover Magazine, where I got some of my first writing clips. And that's where he used to edit. And because we were in the same city at that time, we got a coffee and just started talking about like what else I was thinking about. And then for my first Harper's commission, also for online, that was about 3 years into freelancing, I kind of made it a goal to get a byline at Harper's. And on a trip to New York City, I asked one of their editors out to coffee, where I did something really similar to that first coffee meeting I just talked about. And yeah, I talked about what I was working on and learned about what they were looking for web and the magazine.
I think this is fascinating because most people think you're just cold pitching these editors, but you're using the strategies that we talked about in our relationship building episode to talk human to human and figure out what these places need. So I love hearing about this. I do want to tease out a few things in what you just said. So first, Wudan, you said you made it a goal to get published in Harper's. Do you set goal publications often? Like, is this a thing that you often do?
I did really early on. Like, through the first 3 to 4 years of my career, I think my goal for year one was to just start writing and publishing features, which I did. My goal through years 2 to 4 were to start working on projects I wanted to and for more stories to land in recognizable places. Again, I didn't go to journalism school, so I didn't have an institution to hang my name on, and I felt like I needed some more prestige outlets to do that legwork for me. But yes, I'm a big goal setter, and I would say it helps me prioritize who I should be pitching, you know, if I have a story idea and I have a priority list.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm reminded of my recent New York Times byline, right, where I realized that it does make sense to pitch ambitiously. Like, if you're telling yourself you can't get published in one of your goal publications and then you never send the pitch, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you have to try and see what happens. The other thing I wanted to ask you is about your process. So do you wait until you find a story that seems right for that goal publication? Or do you sit down and come up with ideas that are specifically for that place?
This is a fascinating question, and I think it can go both ways. So it depends on the story for sure. I think if I had a goal publication, I might start looking for stories through the lens of that newspaper or magazine, if that makes sense. Like, I would find a story idea, and then I would ask myself, is this a Washington Post story? Is this a Wired story? But most of the time I look at a topic and see how it can be a story for different publications.
That's super interesting. I think I often tell my coaching clients, like, every story has 7 or 8 different angles that you could use, and it's going to depend on where you pitch it. So I love hearing that you do that. I also want to talk about pitching long form work, because you do a lot of that, and I think it's ambitious. It's also a really good way to build new skills and show editors, show the world what you can really do, right? I think I've talked about this maybe on the podcast, definitely in places online, always to my coaching clients. But one of my old professors used to say there's a maximum and a minimum for every story. Like, there's a big version, a little version, and everything in between. So I think it's cool that you're often pitching that maximum version. Can you tell me what that is like?
Yes, I agree that I think it's important to have clips that really showcase the type of work you want to do. So first of all, I think you should align yourself with an editor who believes that you can pull off this work, especially if it's your first feature story. I pick where to pitch a story in part based on this. And I would say I got my first feature assignment about 6 months into freelancing, and it was honestly horrifying. I think I got the commission and I freaked out. I was like, I don't know how to write a feature, but I was working with an editor who saw my potential.
I totally know that horror feeling, like, oh my God, now I have to actually write this story that I've pitched. What have I done? I'm curious, how do you think they saw your potential given that you hadn't written long before?
I was fact checking for them. And like I said before, fact checking has been and probably always will be my Trojan horse to get into writing for those same publications. And honestly, it just takes a few clips to show the rest of the world that yes, writing long is a thing you do. Over time, people will just trust you more and more with it. I think that first year of freelancing, I probably had 2, maybe 3 features, and that was convincing enough to an editor that, like, yes, they should take me on for an internship where I would do more of that work.
This to me is a big career building issue for a lot of freelancers. I think a lot of us, and I'm including myself in that, just take on the assignments that come our way, right? Because money is important and work is good and we like to feel productive. But sometimes your brand, let's call it, can get diffuse because of this and you lose direction. Like, you look up and realize, I've been writing for a year, but none of my clips actually show the work I want to be doing long term. Like, maybe I want to do long form work, but I haven't done it because I haven't thought about, you know, directing my pitches in that way.
Yeah, I feel that 100%.
This is actually, I think this is hard for me personally. Like, I get in the zone of working and being productive, and then I'll have this moment where I look up and I'm like, oh wait, I actually want to be doing that thing and I'm not. Like, I'm writing stories about running shoes, but I'm not going to show these off to people when they ask what they want to be doing. So I really want to be writing about, for example, like, the psychology of parenting. And then that means I need to recalibrate and make sure I'm actually doing that work. And I hear this from so many writers. I think it's kind of the nature of our business that our priorities change as we change as people, which is really natural, but we have to pay attention to building our career in the direction we want it to go, or else we can end up, like, way out in left field. And this is why Wudan and I are so big on interrogating goals and values. Like, if you don't know where you're going, you can't get there. And as Wudan is saying, you can't build stories that show off your skills and help you reach your goals unless you're putting time and effort toward that work. It sounds simple, but it is very, very hard. So, Wudan, let's talk more about passion projects and how to make them happen. Like, if you have in your mind that you want to do something and you're just starting out, what's the next step? I think you're so good at this.
Yeah, I love talking about this. The not-so-secret answer is to get grants and fellowships. I think it's very unlikely that, for instance, if you have a story that involves overseas travel and you've never done that before, a publication will not take that chance on you. Like, they are not going to take thousands of dollars from that publisher and, like, spend it on you, right? But if that publication wants your story, you can use their interest to apply for a grant that will cover those reporting costs. And if you're lucky, also for your time for being on the ground.
How do people find these fellowships or grants?
Oof, people ask this all the time. I don't think there is a magic list. I personally like to curate my own list of what's available and the deadlines. I recommend this because everyone's interests are different. And so as I find grants, I put them on like a running sticky note on my desktop and make note of the deadlines.
I think Study Hall has a good running list often too. And many media newsletters are also going to include notes on grants from time to time. Because I do the same. I keep a list of places or ideas where I might want to apply on a sticky. And I think in general, grants and fellowships are a really underrated way of building your career. Like, I didn't know very much about them until I became friends with you, Wudan. And sometimes fellowships even come with support or classes or other learning opportunities. And they're also often targeted at early career journalists. I just think they're such a good resource that is often untapped. I would love to hear from you about what makes a successful application for one of these grants or fellowships.
I would say a few things. First of all, the scope of the project needs to be super clear. And it's on you, the applicant, to basically explain why the story is important and why it needs to be told now. Same thing you would do with a story pitch. And the second really big thing is to either have the portfolio to back yourself up, or even better, letters of interest or letters of commission from editors at publication. Funders want to know that you're going to produce something that will end up in the world.
Yeah, I think the good news about this is if you're pitching the story, you probably are able to then pitch it, you know, within the context of a fellowship and understand why it's important and why it needs to be told. You are super good at getting grants, Wudan. And one of the awesome things that you will get if you're an all-access member, along with this episode, is examples of Wudan's successful grant applications. I feel like this is like a super, one of the best resources we've offered. We're also planning to do a webinar on applying for grants and fellowships later this summer, so stay tuned for that.
I am looking forward to that. Okay, next on growing your career. Jenny, let's talk about earning more money as a benchmark of giving yourself that raise, right?
Money. I love money. Yes, I think this is important because as a freelancer, the only person who's going to give you a raise is you. You are your boss.
So how do you do that? How do you give yourself a raise?
This year, I was like, okay, I need to work less because child, and also because my skills are more developed than they were 2 years ago, that means my market value has increased, right? I have a master's degree. I have a portfolio of impressive clients. It is time for me to value my skills a little bit more. The cost of living increases happen when you work at a publication for a reason and you get promoted for a reason, right? So a lot of this comes back to setting boundaries, which I know we have basically talked about ad nauseum on this podcast, but I decided I needed to make more. I figured out what it would look like to give myself a raise of about $5 an hour on top of my usual rate, or at least about 20 cents a word more per story than before. I wrote those numbers on a sticky note and I put them next to my computer. Now, when I negotiate, I use those new numbers for my hourly rate and my by the word rate. And I use that hourly rate to determine my project rate. So it's like, you know, I know my work is even more valuable to clients now. They're getting more from me during the time than they would have 2 years ago. It's a smart investment for them. And this also means, though, that I drop clients that no longer fit within the bounds of my new pricing model. So this year, I've pivoted away from certain clients, right? They don't match my priorities. They don't match the work I want to be doing. They don't match my, they can't pay me enough. So I've been doing a lot of work lately to think about where I want to go in the next year or two. And you can't do something new if you keep all your same old stuff, same clients, same rates. Expansion doesn't happen when you stay in your little box. There is a decision-making process there about clients and about your own value. I feel like Wudan and I are often preaching this on Twitter. A lot of rate setting comes back to valuing yourself, right? Valuing your work. And I think this is a skill we need to talk about more as freelancers, honestly. At a full-time job, you would have a manager who's like, wow, Wudan, you're doing such good work. You've been here for 5 years. It's time to expand your skill set. I'm going to put you in a new role, pay you more, give you more responsibility, and watch you learn. As a freelancer, you have to make that happen for yourself, which I know is bold. It takes a lot of trial and error and practice, but it's super worth it. So I want to say loudly to y'all who are listening, consider giving yourself a raise. If it's been a year or more since you determined your rates, go back and look at them. It might be time to change them.
I have one client who gives me a raise every single year, but nobody else does. So I like to renegotiate rates at a place I have an ongoing relationship with about every year or so. And for some magazines I work with, my rates sort of change based on the scope of the project. And I want to say that as a last point, the longer I do this kind of work, the faster I get. So I actually benefit a lot from project rates, and I encourage other freelancers to think about things similarly because project rates hide that hourly rate And when I just agree to a project rate, usually my hourly rate is higher, which creates more time and space for me to take on more work. So I also love the idea of learning new skills, right? Like over the years, I've taken on photo, I've sold my photos, and now we're kind of both looking at this brand new world of audio.
Yeah, this is where I think some of those extra certifications or explorations might make sense too. Like if you want to dive into a new topic or increase your expertise by adding a marketable skill, which would allow you to, you know, by proxy, give yourself a raise, right? That might be a good idea. I was recently talking to someone about learning SEO or social distribution techniques and doing like a, you know, a pointer class about that. The question is really, how can you continue to learn and expand so that you feel like your skills are expanding? And then when you ask for that raise, it feels warranted, right? Conferences are great. Talks are great. Books are solid. So is just taking on a new project and learning as you go, like this podcast. The continuing education is up to you as a freelancer. And that can be both scary, but I think it's also really cool. I have worked at publications where they've told me I'm too ambitious when I want to take on a project that might be new to me. And when you're working for yourself, you can just do it. So I think this might be a good idea as we head into the recession now too. Like diversifying your service offerings by adding a new skill to your resume seems really smart. The last thing that we are going to talk about on this episode is using freelancing as a stepping stone to a staff job or a buffer between staff jobs, because I know we talk about freelancing as being a career in and of itself, but I think that, you know, for a lot of us, we will go back and forth between staff jobs during our career.
Yeah, and that's totally acceptable for sure.
Yeah, a lot of new grads who are coming out of journalism programs right now, I think maybe will need to start as freelancers too, given the recession and the state of the job market. This is cool because you're going to get to shape your career from day one, but then eventually you might want a full-time gig so you can get the benefit of mentorship and consistency, and you'll want to prepare your resume in a certain way to sort of parlay this freelance experience and show what you can do at a staff job.
Yes, I second this. I update my resume every quarter because sometimes I need to apply for fellowships, and a lot can happen in a quarter. So this week I spoke with Adina Solomon about resumes. So let's play that part. Adina is a freelance journalist based in Atlanta, Georgia, who writes about city planning, business, and death. She also writes, edits, and consults on resumes for freelancers and other professionals, and that's through her business, Relevant Resume. Adina, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Totally. So why don't I want you to start, maybe we can talk about why is it important for freelancers to have a resume at all?
So that's a good question, because I think we usually think of resumes as for people who, you know, have staff jobs and work for companies and are applying for other companies. But I think it's a good idea for freelancers to also have a resume. Of course, if you're a freelancer and you are looking to move into a full-time job, you'll definitely need one. But in addition, there's a good bit of, you know, part-time contract work that a freelancer could apply for that asks for a resume too. And if you're not applying to jobs like that, you can need one when applying to different programs and fellowships and grants. And it's just a good idea to have one, because really what it is, it's a summary that you create of your accomplishments and your career experience, and it's the most kind of efficient way to communicate the highlights of what you've been through in your career, even for a freelancer.
Definitely. Yeah, it's a good way, I think, to synthesize everything. And I usually revisit mine at least, you know, every quarter and try to keep it up to date. So Adina, what makes a good resume?
So, you know, at the end of the day, a resume is a marketing tool for yourself and for any sort of work or jobs or anything that you want to get. So it really should be easy to read. I think people don't spend that long, you know, reading a resume. I think there's some statistic out there saying that a typical resume is only read for the first time, you know, like under a minute. You know, it's really just kind of a glance, a really quick read. So you really need to quickly communicate with a resume, you know, what you're about and what you do. That means it needs to be easily scanned by the person reading it and written in such a way that someone could really quickly know your job and your work and anything else you want to communicate, any awards you've gotten, any accomplishments you're really proud of. They really needed that quickly. So a good resume should be able to do that. And you can do that, of course, through the way you write it. You can do that with the headings you choose, design you choose, that sort of thing.
For sure. That makes a lot of sense. And I guess on a more granular level, like if a freelancer wanted to write their own, how should they think about building theirs?
So there are an infinite number of ways to write a resume. There's no one way for, you know, everybody. It really can depend on what you want to do with the resume and what your career has looked like thus far and all that kind of stuff. But kind of think about what works for you and what works for what you're using the resume for. So for some people, they can just have a pretty traditional listing of jobs that they've held along with, you know, that sort of description of each position. That works for some people. But for other people, for other freelancers, what works is a section detailing some of their biggest accomplishments. And there's just a lot of ways to do it. So kind of think about what you're applying to. If you're applying to a specific program that asks for certain qualifications, you know, make sure those qualifications are really apparent when people read your resume quickly and they're hopefully up top in case, you know, someone doesn't get to the bottom of that resume. So really think about what you're going to use it for.
When you're demarcating different things or sections, right? Is that by skill?
It, again, depends on the person, but I think it can really work to have, you know, different sections for different skills. If you have, you know, one section for, let's say, your writing skills, one section for, you know, investigation skills, fact-checking skills, that can really work well.
What mistakes do you commonly see freelancers making when they're writing up their resume?
So I see a lot of freelancers trying to fit everything on their resume that they've ever done and just kind of cramming it full. And people with full-time jobs, like at companies, do this too. But this is, I feel like this is even more true for freelancers because you can be juggling a lot of balls, right? Like you're not at one company, you're working for a lot of different entities. So it can be really easy for your resume to kind of balloon. I've seen freelancers try to put just about every place they've ever written for, you know, on your resume, which probably isn't possible, really. So it's best to keep your resume to 2 pages or less. Remember that just a resume will not, it's never going to fit everything you've done. It's really just a highlight reel. So you need to pick the biggest or most significant things. Like if you're a contributing editor somewhere, I'd probably include that in your resume since that's kind of a more of a long-term thing. But if you wrote 500 words for a publication one time, it's less likely that you need to include that, you know, on a separate line that says that you were a writer at so, such and such publication during March 2019. Like I've seen people try to do that, like have a line for each thing. And it's just, I don't think it works very well because it can make a resume kind of busy and difficult to read, which, you know, kind of detracts from the purpose, which is again, to be that highlight reel and allow people to find out what you're about quickly.
Definitely. And when you interviewed me for my resume, we talked about at what point do you take things off, like internships. So what advice do you have on that front?
I think it can be very tempting to leave things like internships on a resume for a long time because a lot of times internships are really important to, you know, when you started in your work and they can be foundational. And just because you take off your resume doesn't mean that, you know, they're not still of importance, you know, to you. But a resume is, again, supposed to be this kind of, you know, marketing tool to show what you do. And it's also supposed to show things that, in general, are a bit more on the current side. And internships are one of those things that you kind of have to evaluate whether you want to keep on as you progress in your career. So if someone is, I don't know, 6 months, a year out of school, something like that, there's a really good case for keeping internships on. You know, maybe they probably don't have as much career experience yet at that point. But I don't know, if you're a few years more into your career, 5 years, 10 years, I don't think it's as relevant anymore because at that point, you've done a lot of other work, a lot of work outside of internships. So in general, I think it's the idea to take it off after 1 to 2 years. I can see an argument for more depending on the person. I mean, there's no one size fits all response, but it's a good idea to eventually take it off and kind of open the door for your resume to more current things that you've been doing. Because again, you are trying to keep it to 1 to 2 pages.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. I think it's a question of, is this experience still serving what I needed to do for me to apply for this part-time gig or this fellowship or even a full-time job, right?
Yeah, exactly. You have to evaluate if it's going to serve you well as you're applying to whatever you're applying to. I've done resumes before for people who have been in their careers for 15 to 20 years, and they still have internships on their resumes. And it just makes the resume very long. And it also, I think it can sometimes give the impression that, you know, you're not updating your resume and you're not adapting it to whatever job or program or anything you're applying for. It makes you think that the resume is just like an anthology of everywhere you've ever worked. You don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Nobody's really got time for all of that. Dina, that was great. Thank you so much for speaking to us about resumes on the show. If you are an All Access member for the Writers Co-op on Patreon, this week we will have a template of what a good resume looks like. It's actually my resume. So that'll be pretty fascinating to just have out there as a resource. Well, thank you so much again, Adina.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I love all this information from Adina. I think I sometimes struggle to convey my freelance experience on a resume. Like, I'm like, here I am. I have done 30 things in the past year. Here is the list. So her advice is really good about focusing down on like what story you want to tell.
Agreed. So there was a lot to pack into this episode on building your careers. I think the too long, didn't read version is that career building comes in so many different forms and flavors for freelancers, and there are different ways to empower yourselves to make these moves.
That freedom is actually one of the most glorious parts of working for yourself, I think. There's no one to tell you that you can't go in a certain direction or learn a new thing. And we will include a whole host of resources this week in the learning portal for All Access and VIP members to help you figure out your own career goals. So we're going to do examples of successful grant applications, like we said, as well as a career goal setting worksheet and a set of give yourself a raise prompts to figure out if you should be making more. We will also include some links in our newsletter to give you a sense of where to look if you want continuing education or grant or fellowship opportunities. And as per usual, we're always around on the internet to answer questions on Twitter or email or Instagram or wherever.
I feel like this week's All Access member package is the best.
I agree.
Yeah, there's just so much on there. Well, that's a wrap for season one.
Wow, so crazy. Well, I guess unless you're a Patreon subscriber, in which case you will hear from us in 2 weeks with our secret episode. I actually just did that interview, and let me tell you, it is great.
If you still need to be convinced to join us, like we said before, the secret episode is about what we believe to be truly, truly key in running a successful freelance business. I feel like every other episode, we're like, this is really important. But I think this secret sauce episode is it.
Yeah, it's sort of the baseline. I am really looking forward to that episode. It's one of my favorite interviews I've done in a long time. And I really wish I had had that episode to listen to when I was just starting out as a freelancer.
Totally. Me too. Well, we will be back in the fall with another season interviewing other freelancers about their business models and how they found success. Ghostwriters, novelists, social media managers, influencers, long-form journalists, beat reporters, editors, fact-checkers. It's going to be really fun.
Yeah, I'm excited. If you heard Boudin say that and you're like, whoa, that successful business-obsessed freelancer is me or someone you know, please write to us. We would love to hear from you. We're filling up our schedule now for that season, and it's going to be a fun time. You can email us at thewriterscoop2@gmail.com.
That's thewriterscoop, all one word, no dashes. And then the letter 2@gmail.com.
Okay, well, I will see you on the internet, Boudin.
Bye, Jenny. Season 1 of the Writers Co-op is made possible by a grant from the National Association of Science Writers. The Writers Co-op is hosted by me, Boudin Gan, and Jenny Gritters, and produced by Susan Fallon.